CRN Digital Talk Radio, Chuck Wilder here. I got Mike, and he is at the network, and we're live across America and around the world at crntalk.com, iHeartRadios, Blueberry, all those ways to get us, yes. Without further delay, I want to go to Christopher Kelly. He is an American history writer based in Seattle and London, co-author with English historian Stuart Laycock of the book America Invaded. It's a state-by-state guide to fighting on American soil. Other titles by Kelly and Laycock include America Invades, How America Has Invaded or Been Militarily Involved with Nearly Every Country on Earth, and Italy Invades, How Italians Have Conquered the World. Kelly has also edited an adventure in 1914. It's the true story of an American family's journey on the brink of World War I. Welcome back, Christopher. How are you?
Chuck, great to be with you tonight.
Well,
today,
I tell you, yes, whatever it is. And you never know. You know, this show is repeated so many times, it might be, who knows?
Yes.
You know, what a book. And I got to tell you something, listener, you know, not blowing any wind, all right? When you pick up one of these books, and especially this one here, the latest, America Invaded, because, I mean, we are talking about the United States of America, and Kelly gives you every single state and how they've been invaded, how many times they've been invaded, by whom they were invaded by. And you just don't want to put it down. I mean, you'll pick up, you'll hear something about Walmart and say, I think I'll check out Arkansas and see how many times they got invaded. Or you'll say, I'll bet you that Utah never got invaded. Well, I got to tell you, yes. And on this particular day, and at the time of this broadcast, no telling when it's repeated and played again and again and again, the 76th anniversary of Pearl Harbor Day, you remind us that Americans often forget and assume that, you know, we're not going to be invaded or attacked. You have to remember at one time, and you know, that you had the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, and I guess you had this false security, right, Christopher,
right,
because of the two great oceans?
That's right. I mean, you think of the oceans, the Pacific and the Atlantic, as these giant moats that protect our country. But, in fact, those moats can sometimes be highways. And, of course, that was a highway, you know, 76 years ago with the attack on Pearl Harbor, for example. So yes, I mean, there are lots of seaborne invasions of American territory, you know, over many, many years. So 76 years ago, trouble was headed to paradise. I mean, with the Imperial Japanese Navy steaming towards Pearl Harbor with maintaining radio silence and really coming as an almost complete surprise to the defenders of Pearl Harbor, where they caught the U.S. Navy on Battleship Row, you know, anchored, you know, ship to ship and destroyed much of the fleet, killed about 2,500 people on that day 76 years ago.
Yeah. And you know what I'd like to do? I'd like to do I have a page number? You know what? I don't even have a page number on this. Did you leave out page numbers? No, here it is. Okay. It's going to be
page.
It's going to be page 90.
Hawaii chapter.
We talked
about the Hawaii chapter about the Pearl Harbor attack.
How did you know that I was going to Hawaii? But you know what? I'm gonna throw you a curve here, Christopher.
And, sure.
And I got to tell you something, listener. Christopher's been on times before, and I know what he's capable of. And you can't throw him a curve. You know, you watch out. He's got a home run every time he's here. I found it very interesting that although it's, you know, December 7th, and we're really going to get into the attacks and stuff like that, and also I'm going to go to my home state here, that I'm, you know, California, and
sure,
and we'll talk about just the attacks from the result of the Japanese, okay, on California.
Right.
We'll get to
right.
that, and you don't want to miss that. But Hawaii, you know, Hawaii is such an interesting state. And what was the guy's name, Cook? Was it Captain Cook? Was he the first guy that started wreaking havoc there?
Yes, he was the first European to really arrive. Captain Cook of the Royal Navy, British Navy, who arrived. First time he was almost worshipped as a god, and then he went up to Alaska. Then the Cook Inlet up in Alaska is named after him, of course. I mean, Cook got around. He was in New Zealand, Australia, all over. the Pacific. But then he returned second voyage to the Hawaiian Islands, which he called at the time the Sandwich Islands. And it was then that he was actually attacked by the natives and killed and even eaten. You could say that Captain Cook got cooked, so to speak, too. You had violent encounters between Europeans and the native Hawaiians right from the beginning.
And you say that the first threats to the independence of the Hawaiian kingdom did not come from Britain or America. Astonishingly, they came from the Russians and the French. So was this a Russia collusion, Christopher?
Russians are timely these days. I mean, have gotten around surprisingly. I mean, like, people, you know, don't remember as much about this, but I mean, you're from California. I was originally from California. I grew up with Russian River nearby. The Russians built a fort at Fort Ross, which is a state park today in Sonoma County. They had a colony in Alaska. They went to the Russians went to Hawaii at one point, and then, as you mentioned, even the French, had
the one in Hawaii. The invasion was 1816. Russian.
That's right. That's right. We're talking 1816. We're talking way back. I mean, so the Russians have been in America. I mean, have been deeply involved in America. And it was only 1867 that Alaska was sold by the Russian Empire to the United States, which in the purchase they called Seward's Folly, which of course, you know, turned out to be a tremendous deal, of course, for our country. I mean, buying all of Alaska for, you know, not really a lot of money.
Yeah. And then 1819 is when the American missionaries began arriving in Hawaii, you say. And
right.
It was interesting how, you know, it's when you come into somebody else's home, all right, and you say, well, now from now on we're going to ban this and blah, blah, blah. But boxing was banned? That's interesting.
Yeah. They banned. I mean, the Hawaiians like to fight, and they like to, you know, bet on boxing. And the missionaries didn't. The Christian missionaries didn't approve of. They weren't worried about the boxing, the fighting, but they were worried about the betting, and they kind of clamped down on boxing in Hawaii. And then they also they were Protestant missionaries, and they actually banned Catholicism, and that's what the French were upset about, and why the
Catholic
French
religion, right?
It was religion. They wanted to, I mean, the French wanted to say, like you've got to have religious tolerance and religious freedom, and you can't just ban one religion because you're Protestant missionaries.
Yeah, is Catholicism, is that the Catholic religion?
Roman Catholicism, yes. Yeah, the Catholic religion, yes.
And interesting, throughout this book, you find where they didn't want the Catholic religion. I mean, you go to New Mexico, you know, and the Spaniards brought it in, and the Indians said, no, we don't want it. But, you know, you probably know right offhand, because the way you are, how many states didn't want the Catholic religion originally?
I'm not sure of that offhand. I mean, there were, of course, and there still are, you know, some parts of the world where, you know, Catholic and Protestant tension. I mean, Ireland, obviously, you know, used to have a Northern Ireland. There were terrorism up until, you know, the 1980s, 90s and things were going on. And so you had, and then recently they've had a reduction in that, you know, fortunately. But I mean, you've had tensions between religious groups for a long time. Yes, there were some that were, you know, persecuted, and the Mormons, for instance, were driven. I talk about them in the book, and a couple different states where they ran into trouble, and then they ended up going to Utah, and you know, but they, you know, suffered from violence, and there was actually a big U.S. Army contingent based in Utah, trying to control the Mormons for a while in the 19th century as well.
Now, here's a surprising fact for you, listener, from this book: the United States Civil War gave Hawaii an economic boom. Now, the Civil War, all right? Never knew that, that's for sure.
That's right. They sold things. And it's interesting that Native Hawaiians ended up fighting, actually, some on both sides. Some joined the Union Army, and then some actually joined the Confederates, who were Confederate raiders, because they were actually Confederate raiders in the Pacific, in the west coast of the United States. and some Native Hawaiians served there both. So you have cemeteries where you've got Native Hawaiians that were, you know, on both sides in the Civil War, in the U.S. Civil War.
12. You say 12 of them served on the CSS Shenandoah merchant raider that terrorized Union ships in the Pacific.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. Yes, exactly. So, yeah, no, you had, you know, Hawaiians, they were kind of natural warriors. They loved to box. They loved to fight. They fought long before Captain Cook arrived. They were fighting each other. Uh-huh. And so, I mean, they were, you know, kind of, you know, used to conflict and all of that. And so, yeah, so they did fight in the Civil War. And I guess the Civil War, I mean, they were interested. I mean, Union soldiers were interested in buying cattle and stuff for the supplies for the soldiers. And
yeah, and coal and everything. Yeah.
Yes.
So then we move on. The Spanish-American War, all right, 1898. You see how we're building up to 1941? Yes.
Yes.
Boy, how do I do this? I don't know. Anyway, 1898, Spanish-American War, U.S. Navy ships passed through Pearl Harbor. This was to recoal, all right, not the other guys. They recoal their ways to the war in the Philippines. And then you say when the Philippines became an American colony, the critical strategic need for Pearl Harbor was evident. And then,
That's right, because the ships depended upon coal for their source of fuel supply.
Right.
And so you had to have coaling stations because, you know, you couldn't, you know, it wasn't like a nuclear powered carrier or for instance, a ship of sail either that needed that coal in order to keep going. So they needed to have ports spread out around the world in order to facilitate that coal driven Navy. And of course, yes, you had Dewey won a great victory at the Battle of Manila Bay against the Spanish in the Spanish-American War, and then of course the Philippines became a kind of a colony of the United States after that.
And when you think of Pearl Harbor, all the movies you've seen and everything you read about in December 7th, and we got about a minute before we're going to have to take a break here. I just want to give you a heads up. Is you hear Schofield Barracks? See.
Yep.
Well, in 1916, they're mentioned in this book. 1916, the 32nd Infantry Regiment, right?
Yep.
Known as the Queen's Own, were mustered at Schofield Barracks. The only Royal Regiment in the U.S. Army marched on parade before the former Queen. Now.
Right, the Hawaiian Queen, of course. I mean, that you had this royal family in Hawaii, uh-huh. like King Kamehameha, and all of those that you see tourists see, and you see on Hawaii 5-0, for example. And so, yeah, the only Royal Regiment in the U.S. Army was in Hawaii, was the 32nd.
And a hero in World War II, believe it or not, from 1925 to 1927, there was a gentleman named George Patton. And he was the officer at Schofield Barracks in Honolulu. Maybe he should have been there on the 7th. I don't know. We're going to take a break and come back. More of this stuff as we get into the Day of Infamy, Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. And this book is America Invaded. It is a state-by-state guide to fighting on American soil. And the website is AmericaInvaded.com. Not American, AmericaInvaded.com. Probably available at Amazon, too. We'll check when we come back. More from Christopher Kelly. Don't go away.
Going to do with your old car? You can try selling it, you could junk it, or you could donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-785-9618. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not, it will be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car, and as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now, 1-800-785-9618. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-785-9618. That's 1-800-785-9618.
Attention small business owners. Growing your business can be tough. Just when you thought you were making money, you found out that you owe the government money. And now that you owe the IRS their cut of your business profits, you may be broke. And if you don't take things seriously, you could go to jail or have your business shut down. But you do have an option. If the IRS is threatening you for unpaid taxes, call the Tax Resources Network. Their tax professionals and ex-IRS agents have over 23 years of experience dealing with the IRS, saving business owners and the self-employed millions in tax dollars. Let us negotiate with the IRS on your behalf. We may be able to reduce your tax debt for a lot less than you owe, help with the IRS audit, and even criminal investigations. If your business owes the IRS $15,000 or more and the IRS is threatening you, don't wait and let your business get shut down or worse. Call for a free consultation. Call 800-989-1647. 800-989-1647. 989-1647. That's 800-989-1647. Again, 800-989-1647.
Experience a luxury boutique hotel escape in the heart of Laguna Beach, California, with the finest art gallery, shopping, dining, and nightlife just steps from your door. The heart of Laguna Beach, the edge of the sea. It's the Inn at Laguna Beach. Enjoy our comfortable rooms, blending the style of a timeless beach bungalow with the modern comforts of today. 70 newly appointed guest rooms and suites await you at the Inn at Laguna Beach. Then, relax at the rooftop bar, where you'll indulge in breathtaking views of the ocean. For dining, you'll find libations and local cuisine on the California coastline, including dining at the legendary Las Brisas, a Southern California landmark. The Inn at Laguna Beach, footsteps from Rome to village to sea, located in the heart of Laguna Beach. The Inn is within walking distance of all that Laguna Beach has to offer. No car required. The Inn at Laguna Beach, 211 North Coast Highway in Laguna Beach, California. Call 800-544-4479 or visit innatlagunabeach.com.
Everybody's talking at me. CRN Chuck Wilder with my guest Christopher Kelly discussing his latest, America Invaded. Is it available on Amazon now?
Yes, absolutely. You can find it at Amazon, on Kindle as well, and as well as on our website at AmericaInvaded.com too.
All right. And I'm going to tell you something, listener. Now, the reason you waited, Mr. and Mrs. Listener, is because if you haven't heard this, this is going to blow your socks off. I was talking about George Patton, 1925 to 27. He was the officer at Schofield. And in 1937, he wrote a report. And I'm going to let Christopher tell you about this report, all right? Run with it, sir.
80 years ago, George Patton had this to say. I'm quoting him. He said, "The unheralded arrival during a period of profound peace of a Japanese expeditionary force within 200 miles of Oahu during darkness, this force to be preceded by submarines who will be in the immediate vicinity of Pearl Harbor, an air attack by Japanese Navy fighters and carrier-borne bombers on air stations in the submarine base using either gas or incendiary bombs." And so Patton, in 1937, 4 years before Pearl Harbor, basically predicted it almost really 100% accurately. I mean, that's exactly what happened 4 years later. Now, Patton wasn't a rare bird, of course. I mean, he was a great, you know, military genius, I think. And he saw the future. I mean, he really kind of saw what was happening. And I'm told that the reason why he became suspicious of the Japanese and why he wrote this report is that he, and I didn't mention this in the book, but I learned about it subsequently, was that he learned that there was this communication going back and forth between Japanese naval officers and some Japanese residents of Hawaii. And that when the Japanese were asked about this by intelligence people from the American services, they said, oh, well, it was just visiting family members. But Patton knew that the officers of the Japanese Navy were from kind of the warrior caste, like kind of a samurai caste, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so whereas the residents of Hawaii, the Japanese residents of Hawaii, were more likely to be, you know, peasants and farmers. And so it was really very unlikely that they would have been family members. And he, Patton, became suspicious because of that. And so that's kind of was one of the things that, that led him to writing this report 80 years ago.
And, you know, when he was mentioning the, if I can find it, the, anyway, about the, did he say miniature? He just said preceded by submarines.
Right.
And it was the two-man midget submarines of the Imperial Japanese Navy that managed to get into Pearl Harbor, you say, undetected. One
right.
sunk by the USS Ward, which was a old World War One U.S. Navy destroyer. And
right.
the midget subs, you said, did no real damage. Ensign Kuzo Kasamaki, thank you, the only survivor. He washed up on shore on the beach there and became the first Japanese prisoner of war captured by the Americans in World War II. Wow. He had a lot of back pay coming, I guess, when he got back to Japan.
Yes, so, yes.
So then, and we got a couple of minutes for the break.
Sure.
You say shortly after 7 a.m. on the day of infamy, a large construction of aircraft, of aircraft was detected by the radar stations that were monitored by the Army Signal Corps. And very interesting because, you know, they were expecting planes coming in from the, I'm not sure if it was Midway or the Philippines or even the United States, but anyway, they
from,
were...
From California, B-17s from California that they were expecting, that they misinterpreted, they thought, oh, those are just the B-17s coming in. Well, of course, it was the Japanese attack that they'd spotted on their blips on their radar screens.
Isn't that a... Isn't it amazing how coincidences play such an important part in big events like this? And they just say, yeah, go ahead and shut it down and leave. And I think
right.
there were two guys there, and radar was a brand new thing that was just, you know,
sure.
being used.
Sure.
So,
exactly, yes. And so you had the destructive attack. Of course, the Arizona was blown up. You can still visit the Arizona today. It's an incredibly moving memorial, and you still have the oil from the tears of the Arizona, the little drops of oil that come up from the surface, even now, 76 years after the events.
Well, we're going to take our break now and come back, and when we come back, we'll do the final couple of touches on Pearl Harbor and Hawaii. And then we'll go to California, and then we got to go to Alaska because that plays a important part, too, when you get to the West Coast. All right?
Sure.
All of this from Christopher Kelly, co-author with Stuart Laycock of the book America Invaded, and the website AmericaInvaded.com, available at your favorite bookstores and Amazon.com. Don't go away.
Going to do with your old car? You can try selling it, you could junk it, or you could donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-785-9618. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not, it will be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car, and as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now, 1-800-785-9618. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-785-9618. That's 1-800-785-9618.
Credit cards are sure fun to use, perhaps a little addicting, and they kind of make you feel rich. Well, if you're like most Americans, you've got over 5 maxed out credit cards in your pocket right now, and you can barely make the minimum payments, right? I'd like to personally recommend a company called DebtHelper.com. DebtHelper.com is a licensed and insured nonprofit debt management agency. They can help cut your interest rates by as much as 50% and lower your monthly payments, saving you thousands of dollars in finance charges on your credit card bills. DebtHelper.com does not lend money. DebtHelper's program could have you paying off your credit card debt in full in a 3 to 5 year period. Call DebtHelper.com right now for your free confidential consultation. Today, 866-706-3328, 866-706-3328, 866-706-3328. Credit card management services, Inc., DBA, DebtHelper.com, 1325 North Congress Avenue, number 201, West Palm Beach, Florida, 3341. Down payment of debt may be creditors to increase finance and other charges or undertake collection activity, including litigation.
Calling all party planners, it's not too late. Come to Angelo's and Vinci's Restaurante because good dates are still available for your holiday celebration. Book a holiday party in one of our banquet rooms and receive $200 off the services of our fun and talented disc jockeys. This offer available for events taking place in the month of December on new bookings with banquet room policies subject to availability. Plus, come to our Sunday champagne brunch for just $21.95. Bring your group. It includes an extensive buffet, mimosas, omelets made to order, fresh Belgian waffles, a chocolate fondue station, or try our Holiday Express buffet for your business lunch, just $13.95. Relax in our holiday festivities. One size fits all. Get a gift certificate at Angelo's and Vinci's, named Best Italian Restaurant 2017 on the Orange County Hot List. Festive and decorated for the season with our spectacular Christmas tree in the middle of the Italian town square. Feel the spirit at Angelo's and Vinci's in downtown Fullerton. Call 714-879-4022, 714-879-4022.
Colonel Sanders here with another important holiday message from KFC. This year, don't get the ones you love some lame, boring gift like a new car or jewelry or toys or expensive electronics or any other junk. Nope, get that special someone what they really want. Exactly! A KFC $5 fill-up with 100% white meat popcorn chicken, mashed potatoes and gravy, a biscuit, a cookie, and a drink. It's a perfect gift for all those important people in your life who get hungry right around lunchtime. KFC, it's finger-licking good. Available for a limited time only. Pricing and participation may vary. Tax extra.
Staples knows you can't afford to have your business slow down over the holidays. New customers aren't delivered down your chimney. You won't find new accounts in your stocking. No, you need a busy holiday season to finish the year strong. So promote your business with eye-catching print materials like presentations, brochures, postcards, and promotional products from Staples. And now save 20% off print and marketing services orders of $50 or more. Staples, more holiday success, less holiday stress. Exclusions apply. Ends 12/2/17.
Everybody's talking at me.
Chuck Wilder, CRN, with my guest Christopher Kelly, discussing America Invaded, his latest book. We are talking about the attack on Pearl Harbor, December 7th. You say four battleships in all were sunk, many more ships damaged. Of the American planes on ground, 188 destroyed. Over 2,400 Americans were killed in Hawaii that day. I find it interesting, Christopher, that in a lot of movies and documentaries and stuff where the people start talking about December 7th, 1941, and especially when it comes to the planes, you know, and the movies, Pearl Harbor, they don't show you that they were actually all grouped up, in a big circle in the middle of the airfields because they were trying to protect them from sabotage on land.
Right.
Yeah, and that worked against us. But the Japanese made a few mistakes. These fuel tanks you mentioned in the book, not destroyed. Also, the building, what are they called, the building blocks, where you repair ships? They didn't destroy those.
Yes, the dockyards were more or less intact. They were able to raise. I mean, it's astonishing how many ships they were able to, to raise from the bottom. I mean, Pearl Harbor is a relatively shallow harbor as well. So that, as opposed to a deep water harbor, would have been impossible. But because it's relatively shallow, they were able to raise many of the ships that were sunk that day and refloat them and use them in the rest of the war.
And then again, no U.S. aircraft carriers were in Pearl Harbor. Boy, talk about luck.
That was a huge stroke of luck. I mean, yes, had the carriers been there, then they would have been, Americans would have been even in worse shape after. I mean, as it was, a huge chunk of the U.S. Navy was sunk, but the carriers, of course, were not there, and that was very important for for the future. I mean, then those are carriers that were used at Midway, which we're talking about June of 1942, when the war really kind of in the Pacific really turned around, at least at sea.
Yeah, and then Yamamoto, what was he? He was the one that said Japan.
We waken the sleeping giant.
Yeah, waken the sleeping giant. And, of course, remember Pearl Harbor, as you say, became the rallying cry across all of America. And in March 1st, 1942, the Japanese launched a second, much smaller attack on Pearl Harbor. You were getting ready to say something. Go ahead.
Well, it's just that, I mean, Yamamoto is interesting. He was the architect of the Pearl Harbor attack, and he also had spent time in the United States. He'd mm-hmm. been a student at Harvard. And so it's interesting that when you think about FDR and Yamamoto, but they were both Harvard alumni. And then later, of course, FDR kind of ordered the assassination of Yamamoto in the Solomon Islands when they identified when his plane was going to be in the air. So it was one Harvard alumni killing another one in the course of the war. It was kind of an interesting, a different way of looking at it. But, yes.
Yeah. All right. Let's turn to California. Okay.
Sure.
Let's see here. I thought I had that marked, but apparently you know me. Somewhere here. Yeah, here we go. California. And you wonder, all right, the Japanese attacking the state of California.
Right, that's right.
Now, the first time, here again, those Russians.
Russians in the Fort Ross, yes.
Yeah,
and they were there for like 30 years, from 1812 to 1842. So it wasn't just, you know, overnight or something. I mean, they were there for a fairly long time. And, of course, that time when they were there, it was mainly Spanish California. Mm-hmm. And you had, San Francisco was Yerba Buena, for example. And so yes, you had a definite... you know, different powers in California, the Russians.
Sonoma County, that's where it took place, right?
Sonoma County, exactly.
Yeah.
Fort Ross is in Sonoma County. It's right on the coast on Highway 1. It's a beautiful state park, well worth a visit. And you go there, I was there, and you see the Russian flag, you know, flying over over California, which is, you know, interesting sight to see.
And, you know, and for the listener, they were attacking that area in California because, you know, they were trying to get food and supplies for their colony in Russia, Alaska, before got that.
That's right. That was the reason why they went, they set up Fort Ross, is they were trying to set up a place where they could grow crops to feed their colonists up in Alaska, because obviously, you know, Alaska, with the climate, very difficult to raise crops and to grow food. So that's why that's what brought them down to California in the first place. And then it was actually John Sutter, who of Sutter's Fort in California, who actually, I think, ended up purchasing Fort Ross from the Russians when they left in 1842 or so.
All right. So let's go to page 47. After the Pearl Harbor attack, submarines of the Imperial Japanese Navy prowled offshore of California and gripped fear into the West Coast. And in fact, very interesting about the Rose Bowl.
Sure. The Rose Bowl, of course, everybody knows it's, you know, it played in Pasadena at the Rose Bowl, Big Ten, Pac-10, you know, a duel every year. What happened is right after Pearl Harbor, of course, it was December 7th, initially they canceled the Rose Bowl out of fear of what might happen. And then the Rose Bowl was supposed to be played between Duke and Oregon State. And Duke said, hey, wait a minute, why don't we play it in North Carolina? And so they actually played it in Durham, North Carolina, the only Rose Bowl played outside of California. Oregon State beat Duke 20-16 that day. But so that's the asterisk about the Rose Bowl, is the 1942 Rose Bowl was played in North Carolina, not California.
Yeah, and, you know, I know that it had a lot to do with, you know, they didn't want to turn on the bright lights, see, because then you're going to, all those airplanes coming from Japan that were going to drop bombs and fire missiles,
right,
they'd see the lights. But I had another author on, I don't remember who it was, and they were talking about, but it was funny how baseball, they didn't want to turn off the lights, and they kept them going, you know, a long time, and it was like, nope, got to have that baseball game, football, huh? So... Let's see, December 23rd, 1941, Japanese Navy I-21 sank an oil tanker, And that was the Montebello off the California coast.
Right. And then at 42, you had a submarine that surfaced near Santa Barbara and used its deck guns to shell the Elwood oil refinery. And they didn't do much damage, but they, you know, they used it as a kind of as a propaganda victory that they, you know, said, well, yes, we had to end. And it did cause, you know, some panic, and it kind of led to that incident in L.A., February 25th, the Spielberg movie 1941 was based on slightly, where you had the kind of this false attack, this where they thought that there was a Japanese attack, and this phantom raid, I guess you could call it.
That was February 25th, 1942, air raid.
Right.
Siren. Yeah. Okay.
Right. And they started, you know, firing anti-aircraft into the air, and you know, and 10 tons of ordnance fired into the air, and I mean, actually, they had a few casualties. 8 people were killed, mostly due to heart attacks, apparently.
Yeah.
So, you definitely had fear up and down the West Coast after the Pearl Harbor.
All right. So then, the Battle of Midway plays a pretty important part because it also enters Alaska, which we'll get to in a little bit. But the Battle of Midway, June 1942. Largely eliminated the threat of the Japanese invasion to California and the West Coast. November 1944, one of the most innovative ideas that I discussed this before. Tell them about the balloons, will you?
Sure. The balloon bombs, I mean, it's interesting, and the parallels with, you know, today and you know, back then in World War II, that there is actually a precedent for, I mean, here now Kim Jong-un, we're worried about, does he have ICBMs or not? Does he have intercontinental weapons? But the thing that's interesting is there is actually this historic precedent that even in World War II, Japan was able to attack the United States with these intercontinental balloon bombs. They were called Fugo bombs. Mm-hmm. They were made out of paper and potato paste, and they were manufactured mainly by high school girls in Japan, and they were sent into the jet stream, and thousands of these were deployed. They carried incendiary bombs. The idea was to kind of set the forests ablaze with these bombs, and they landed on at least 15 different American states in the course of the war. They didn't really do very much damage, although there was one that landed in Oregon and was detonated by a group, and 5 teenagers and 1 woman were killed. Those were the only casualties in a warehouse or forest at the time.
And they fell 15 states, you said.
15 different states.
Wow.
That's right. You know, I mean, some, you know, we're going fairly east, like, you know, states like, I believe, Iowa, and certainly Wyoming, and, you know, Montana received several bombs. So, yeah, it was not just the coast that received these bombs, but they, you know, they went into Canada as well, too.
You know, and it was so interesting. I know they got into the airstream, and then they had a altimeter set up somewhere so that it would lower the balloons, right?
I believe that's right. So that at a certain point they would come down. They certainly landed, and there was this incident is not particularly well known because there was a great deal of censorship going on at the time,
mm-hmm.
and the government didn't want people to panic about these attacks. There was one balloon that, and in my adopted home state of Washington, there was one balloon bomb that landed at the Hanford Engineering Works. And the irony of that is that it was at Hanford that they were manufacturing the plutonium that was dropped on Nagasaki.
Wow.
And briefly, the power plant, the atomic plant, was put out of action because of this bomb that kind of got tangled in the electric wires outside the plant. But the Japanese had no idea that they had this kind of success because they didn't hear about. They thought that it was ineffective because there were no media reports of the bombs landing.
So then we go to page 21, and this is Alaska. Soon after the Pearl Harbor attack of December 7th, 1941, you say concern grew about the defensibility of Alaska, and 3 days prior to the Pearl Harbor attack, all of a sudden enters submarines of the Japanese Navy.
Right. Well, what had happened is that, you know, after Pearl Harbor, not too long after, it was about in April of 42, you had Doolittle's raid, where you had Jimmy Doolittle, who led these planes that
Tokyo.
Bombed Tokyo. And Japan, of course, was shocked by that. I mean, it didn't really do very much damage, but they were shocked that, that Tokyo was vulnerable to an attack, and they wanted to set up a defensive perimeter. And so they wanted to set it up as far away from Japan, the home islands, as possible. So that's why they launched towards Midway. They wanted to not just attack naval forces, but they actually wanted to capture and invade the island of Midway, which is technically in the Hawaiian Islands on the outskirts of it. And then they also sent a northern fleet up to Alaska at that time. And we're talking June of 42.
And was Chris
bombing Dutch Harbor?
Yeah, and to bomb Dutch Harbor, but wasn't it also a divisionary, or what do you call it? Golly, I'm looking for the word. You know, it was like a fake attack in a way to draw off the attention from Midway, because I think people were concerned.
Right.
So Japan was sort of like a diversion. That's the word I was looking for.
A diversion, I see, yes. Well, they did actually land. They took two Aleutian Islands, the Attu and Kiska, were actually invaded and occupied for a while, and it wasn't until the following year that the Americans kind of had to reinvade these islands and liberate them, one of which had already been abandoned and left kind of booby-trapped, but the other one there was some severe fighting on as well. So, but the reason why the Japanese were there and the reason why they went to Midway was to try to protect against this bombing from America. Obviously, that didn't work out very well, and of course during the firebombing of Tokyo was even more devastating than the atomic bombs in terms of casualties later visited upon Japan.
And so the capture in Alaska, that was sort of an embarrassment, was it not, to America?
It was, definitely. I mean, that you had American soil that was clearly, I mean, Alaska technically wasn't a state at that time. It was just American territory. It wasn't until after the war that both Hawaii and Alaska became states.
Right.
But nevertheless, it was certainly American soil. And there was other, I mean, Guam was invaded and occupied by the Japanese. And, of course, the Philippines were, which was a kind of an American colony, at the time, was, of course, invaded and captured by the Japanese. And there were something like